Well, welcome everyone to Whistlin' Dixie here on Monday, the 2nd of May in the year 2022. Just step up on the porch here have a seat, and we're about to have a grand discussion and, pour yourself a glass of lemonade, because this is going to get to be fun. And I am joined today, just a real blessing to have with me on Whistlin' Dixie, Parson Ted Weiland from out there in Nebraska, who is enduring some snowy weather while I am sitting and roasting in 87 degree weather. Parson, how are you today, sir?
Oh, I'm doing just wonderful, blessed beyond what I deserve, and so glad to be with you again, Michael. I've had lots of good response to our last program, and I'm looking forward to what we can accomplish today as well.
Well, thank you, sir. And would you kind of tell the people a little bit about yourself, a little background, and your mission as we understand it? We certainly know that, but please tell us about yourself, and if folks are interested, how they can get more of your message.
Well, I will if you'll do me a favor first, and that is, like with the last program, you're the guy that came up with Parson, and I'd like you to explain, because if this goes out to our list, I know people are going to be wondering why you call me Parson. So I'm not wanting a pat on the back here, but would you mind explaining that again, just so everybody understands why you use that term?
Well, Parson, I don't have a... not even the lightest problem of a holdback without explaining that. And growing up, I was adopted by my grandfather when I was a mere 9-year-old kid, and I grew up with him, and he lived into his 100th year. And I credit him with being one of the most brilliant men I knew, although he only had a second grade education. But he knew men, and he knew their hearts, and he knew so much about history, and he was such a valuable asset to me. And we talked a lot at different times about the difference in the churches in our community. And we had several, we had the Free Will Baptist, the Missionary Baptist, we had, the Methodist, we had several different. And I noticed at one time there was one particular pastor that my grandfather differentiated with the term parson. And I had to ask him one day, I said, wait a minute. You said Preacher Wolf, and you said Preacher Ray, and you said parson. What's the difference? And he said, well, I use that word to differentiate the real from the fake. And so my study of your word, sir, has led me to believe that you're real and you certainly aren't fake. So that is my reason for calling you Parson.
Well, thank you for that. And I thank your grandfather for that as well. And again, I wasn't looking for a pat on the back, but I knew that people might be wondering why you'd use that term. And knowing the background for that, I'm humbled and appreciate very much that you consider me worthy of that term in light of your grandfather's explanation. Well, I think I probably did this in the last time when you asked me to introduce myself, and I usually do this with most interviews that I do. First of all, it's not important who Ted Weiland is, except that he is a servant, a subject, an ambassador of the King of Kings. Who Jesus Christ is, and I sometimes will use the name Yeshua, his given Hebrew name, which means Yah who saves, by the way, for those who may not know that. But it's important that we know who he is, not who we are, but except that we be subjects of his, and that we're, to the best of our ability, doing his will. And I almost always use 1 Corinthians chapter 1 to introduce myself, because it's my chapter, And I always tell people, you can borrow it because you might find yourself in there as well. But this is my passage, and this is Ted Weiland, where in 1 Corinthians 1, Paul wrote to the Corinthians, and he said, for you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty, and the base things of the world, and the things which are despised, God has chosen, yea, and the things which are not, to bring to naught the things that are, that no flesh may glory in his presence. But of him are ye in the Christ Jesus, who of God is made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that according as it is, he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. The fact that he talks about the calling of the foolish and the base and the ignoble, that's Ted Weiland. If anyone finds anything good in me, it's Christ. Because most people who know me now at the age I am now don't know the Ted Weiland that Christ first touched. And he was just a dumb tobacco spit and cuss and bull rider, and that's it. And he chose the foolish for some reason to sometimes confound the wise and to hopefully bring him glory in all things. So that's Ted Weiland. As far as people being able to reach me, I would encourage that they go to our website. It's Bible Verses, and that's Verses spelled out V-E-R-S-U-S, Constitution.org. Bible Verses Constitution.org. There's lots of material on there. I'm either working on my 30th or 31st book. I'm not sure which. Some of them are just booklets, but I'm working on, like I said, 30th or 31st book right now. And all of my books, except for one or two, the curriculum that I put together for the primer for Bible Law Versus the United States Constitution, the Christian Perspective, the curriculum is not online. It was almost impossible to put that online. But all of my other books, everything, any books that we might talk about in this interview, those that are not, are available on my websites, on our online book and article page. And you can go there, the 575-page Bible Law Versus United States Constitution, the Christian Perspective, in which I've assigned a chapter to examining every article and every amendment in the Constitution by the Bible, is online. And so you can get that in. It's also our policy that if anyone wants one of the books themselves rather than dealing with the online versions, and they can't afford an offering, that's fine. We'll send it to them free of charge, provided they will use it either for themselves or for someone else. And we'll be glad to provide those. And in fact, if I'll mention this right off the bat, and that is that if they will go to Bible Verses, V-E-R-S-U-S, Constitution, BibleVersesConstitution.org, go over to the right-hand sidebar, I think it's the second or third from the top, you'll find a survey, a 10-question survey regarding how the Constitution stacks up with the Bible. And if they'll take that survey and fill it out and fill out the form, we will send them a free primer, the 85-page primer of the 575-page Bible Law Versus Constitution book. So they can get that easily by just taking the survey, and we'll be glad to send them that. There's a few other things we'll include with that, but be sure to take advantage of that. The postage is on me. It won't cost you a thing. And, hopefully you'll be, enlightened some by what's in that book and some of the other material on our websites.
Oh, well, thank you so much, sir. And I have always been duly impressed with the fact that you tell people, hey, if you can't afford this, I'll send it to you for free. And I believe that is the very basis of, you know, of your spirit. And I really appreciate that. And, of course, you and I had talked earlier about doing a program on the Bill of Rights. And I said, is it a Bill of Rights or is it a Bill of Goods? And so that is a critical question. But one thing I wanted to touch on, Parson, before we get into that, was my in-depth study of the founding era of America. One of the things that I really got into, and it took me about 3 weeks to really study the sermons that had been introduced during that era of history and the various ministers who had presented those sermons. And so one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to find out the most quoted biblical verse from all of those messages, from all of those sermons that I read in studying that era of history. And the thing that I found remarkable was the most mentioned biblical verse was Galatians 5:1. And, you know, I'm not trying to ambush you here, sir, but I just wanted to throw that out. What significance would you place to Galatians 5:1 being the most mentioned biblical verse during that era?
Well, let me read it to your audience first. It says, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ has made us free, and be not entangled in again a yoke of bondage." Regrettably, that verse actually is misused probably more than it's used properly, because of, at least in our contemporary age, in that the bulk of today's churches are full of Christians who can be known as antinomians. And that term may not be familiar, so let me explain it. The word nomia in the Greek is the word that's translated law in the New Testament. An antinomian are those who teach that the law of God is no longer relevant today under the new covenant. And here's the problem, is they have taken passages like Galatians 5:1 and several others. In fact, there's, if I remember my count, there's 29 different verses that are taken and robbed of their context and their intention and turned around to say that God's law is no longer under effect today. And Galatians 5:1 happens to be one of those. But the problem is that, again, they have been either robbed of their context or they're completely misunderstood. Another one is, we're not under the law, we're under grace. Well, praise God, we're not under the law. But they don't even understand what Paul's intent with that term is. We're no longer under the law. They don't even understand the law that it's no longer. And it's the same law that's being spoken of here in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 1, the law of bondage, the yoke of bondage. It wasn't God's moral law, the Ten Commandments, his, I should say, moral and triune integral, or let me say it again, the triune integral moral law of God, which is his Ten Commandments, the statutes that explain each of those commandments, and the civil judgments that enforce them. Those passages that are used by the antinomians today have nothing to do with God's moral law. And if they just think about it, you do away with God's moral law, the Ten Commandments, their statutes and judgments, you do away with his morality, quote unquote. And if you do away with God's unmorality, you allegedly do away with God himself. That's who God is. And he reveals us through those Ten Commandments, statutes, and judgments. This yoke of bondage, the law that we're no longer under, praise God, is the Mosaic Covenant and its requirement to keep that covenant perfectly in order to be justified by God. It's called if you go back to Galatians 3, which is a pivotal passage for understanding, the added law that was added 430 years after the promises given to Abraham is the Mosaic Covenant. It takes us right to Mount Sinai. It's the Mosaic Covenant that was added and that is no longer in existence, that required perfect obedience in order for the Israelites to be justified before God. But before the added law, most people are totally unaware that the Ten Commandments, statutes, and judgments did not come into existence when Moses came down Mount Sinai. Genesis 26:5, they should go and read that, where it says that that Abraham kept the commandments, statutes, and judgments. And in fact, they go all the way back to Adam and Eve. Why do they go back to Adam and Eve? Because God's morality doesn't change. God doesn't change, thus his morality doesn't change. And thus his moral commandments, the triune, integral moral law of God, the Ten Commandments, statutes, and judgments, were in existence prior to the added covenant being the Mosaic covenant. Now back to Galatians 5, it says, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ has made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage." Don't get entangled with the Mosaic covenant once again, because we're now free in Christ. Now, no one is justified by keeping God's law. That's what was required under the Mosaic covenant. It's not required under the new covenant, the Christian covenant. We're free in Christ. We're under grace under Christ. But that doesn't mean what so many have turned it to mean, turned it on its head, to mean that God's ethical standard for society has been done away as well and is no longer pertinent under the new covenant. And that has created, it's maybe the most damning of all doctrines that are being taught in the church today, has done more damage to what God intends Christendom to be, not Christianity. Regrettably, what was Christendom, that's with D-O-M, not D-U-M-B, like it would be today in most cases, but Christendom in the early 1600s, Christendom meaning Christians dominionizing society on behalf of their God, and that's done with his law, with his Ten Commandments, statutes, and judgments. Regrettably, that has been turned into mere four-walled, stained-glassed, putrefying Christianity today. And a lot of it goes right back to the fact that people are teaching that God's law is no longer in effect. Well, that's the means by which you apply the king's laws in order to advance his kingdom. And all of those laws have the answer for us. This is such a pivotal passage as well. But for example, Psalm 19, 7 through 11, it says, "The law of Yahweh is perfect." The law of Yahweh is perfect. And we're going to see it's talking about the commandments, statutes, and judgments and a couple other things here. "The law of Yahweh is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of Yahweh is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of Yahweh," there's the statutes that explain the commandments. "The statutes of Yahweh are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of Yahweh is pure, enlightening the eyes." There is the commandments. "The fear of Yahweh is clean, enduring forever. The judgments," the civil judgments of Yahweh, "are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired than gold, yea, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is thy servant warned, and keeping them there is great reward." Now, back to your question, Michael. I took a long time there to get to it, but why did they use that passage? I'm not sure. You know, I haven't studied that to know why they used that passage. I hope they used it for the right biblical reason and not the reason that we find so many people using it today, which has been so damaging to Christendom in the days in which we find ourselves living particularly, and what we must get back to. We got to get rid of this idea of mere Christianity and get back to Christendom. Christians dominionizing society on behalf of their king. And when they were doing so here in early 1600 Americas, that's why America became great in the past. Everybody thinks it goes back to the 1700s. Baloney. That's when everything started going wrong. That's when we started to being cursed by God rather than blessed by God, according to Deuteronomy 28. So that's my best answer, not knowing why those guys use that passage. I didn't know that, and I find it very interesting that was the most used passage. I actually thought I had heard before that, and we may be talking about maybe different periods of time, But I had heard it was one of the passages in Deuteronomy, I think. But so I was surprised when you said Galatians 5:1.
Well, I think the passage in Deuteronomy, Parson, was probably the second most used phrase there. But I especially was tuned in to Galatians 5:1 with its mention of slavery and the fact, the irrefutable fact, that the Constitution of 1787, using Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, and Article 6, Clause 2, was absolutely placed the people in the who were under the Constitution, placed them exactly back in slavery, if not physical slavery, fiscal slavery. So your comments on that, please, sir.
Well, you're certainly right on. You know, the idea that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights has brought America liberty is so far-fetched, it's just incredible that anyone believes it. As we were talking before the show, idols die hard. And if you don't want to be popular, and I'm sure you understand this, Michael, take on the Constitution as the exact opposite of what everybody believes it has been, despite all the historical evidence, not even talking about what the Constitution says itself, which there's hardly an article or amendment that's not biblically antithetical or even seditious to Yahweh and his morality. That's what Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, that book, is all about. But even from the historical record, and if we'd only look, you know, just open our eyes and say, look where we're at today. What's the genesis of this? Well, the genesis is 1787, when that cadre of Enlightenment and Masonic theistic rationalists, also known as constitutional framers, don't believe it for a minute when people tell you those guys were Christians. They were theistic rationalists. They did quote scripture from time to time, but they were a mix of both the Enlightenment and the Bible teachings, and they were best described as theistic rationalists. And in fact, they were many of them were outright antichrist, according to 2 John 1:7-11. But all you have to do is look at what's happened. It's been a downward cycle ever since 1787 to where we find ourselves today, where America finds herself precipitously teetering on the precipice of moral depravity and destruction. Liberty? Where's liberty? Now, here's what I always get as a response to this, which I always hope that someone does respond in this fashion. They'll say, well, it's not the Constitution's fault. Or it's not the framers' fault that framed the Constitution. It's those renegade judges and presidents and legislators today. Well, my response to that is, well, have you ever considered how we ended up with such guys and gals? How did it happen? Could it be that it goes back to Article 6 and its ban on Christian test oaths? And somebody say, well, it was religious test oaths. Well, do you consider Christianity a religion? Then it was Christian test oaths, and really what it had in mind were the test oaths in the original state constitutions, which were not anything what they should have been. But in removing the Christian test in the federal government, what really matters is that therein was eliminated the mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders. Remove those, starting with Exodus 18:21, which begins with the fear of Yahweh. Remove those, and you know what you end up with? You end up with nothing but nincompoops, scoundrels, incompetents, immoral reprobates, and outright criminals for your leaders, who then take and ruin even further the even as bad as the Constitution, they even make it worse. But that what that is simply what we find in Hosea when Hosea says, because they, and in this case we'll apply it to the constitutional framers, because they sowed the wind, we're today reaping the whirlwind, including the civil quote-unquote leaders we have today, because the constitutional framers in Article 9 removed any chance of mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders today. So regardless how you cut it, there's no liberty. There's no liberty from what the Constitution has given us. Everything we find today that has gone wrong in America can be traced back, of course, to man's wicked heart to begin with, but can trace back the genesis of it here in America is 1787 and the fact that they created a constitution that's antithetical, if not seditious, in almost every article and amendment to Yahweh's sovereignty and his morality. And even if that hadn't been the case, their sins of omission, those are what they created in the Constitution, you could call their sins of commission. But their sins of omission and the fact that they didn't create a government of, by, and for God instead of a humanistic one of, by, and for the people, but a government of, by, and for God expressly established upon his moral law, the Ten Commandments, their respective statutes and judgments, has sent us alone to the precipice of moral depravity and destruction that we find ourselves on today. Liberty? No. You're right, Michael. It only provided us slavery. I mean, we are the most licensed, the most burdened.
Restricted?
Restricted. I mean, we can come up with all kinds of synonyms for what we find ourselves today. And the genesis is 1787.
Well, Parson, I think there's something we really need to touch on here, and you hit the nail right square on the head, but most people are unaware because, you know, most people get all of their history from the Marxist school system, so they don't get the truth. But at the founding of in 1787, 12 of the 13 colonies or states, whatever you want to call them, had a direct oath to the Christian faith in their state constitutions. So 12 of 13, the only one that didn't have it was Rhode Island. So 12 of 13 had a Christian oath. Yet at the Constitutional Convention, the convention read a letter from Jonah Phillips of the Synagogue of Philadelphia demanding that they remove any oath to the Christian faith in the Constitution. Who did they follow?
By the way, you can find part of that letter in Chapter 9 of Bible Law versus United States Constitution, The Christian Perspective, which deals with Article 6. It's subtitled The Supreme Law of the Land, but that part of that Jonas Phillips's letter, if not, it may even be in its entirety, I'm not sure, but they'll find that letter in that chapter.
Well, if I remember correctly, Parson, the whole thing's there in your work.
Okay. Well, you remember it better than I do. But that's very important because keep in mind, you know, regrettably, Christians have been hoodwinked and hornswoggled into believing that the Jews are the same as Christians when, in fact, again, if you go to 2 John 1, 7 through 11, John, the only one who spoke of the Antichrist, never wrote of a future, a one-man future Antichrist. It was always a plurality of Antichrist in existence at the time. And his description of an Antichrist, both then and of course now as well, is anyone. Well, let me just say it: the Jews were Antichrist, and yet the constitutional framers were influenced by Jonas Phillips, and removed the Christian tests, which again were not anything what they should have been, but at least they had that much. They did not have the mandatory biblical qualifications, which they should have had. But at least,
Parson,
they had the Christian test. Yes, sir.
Well, I'm sorry, sir. Could we have called that a halfway covenant then?
Well, I'm not even sure it was that good. The if we want to go back to our true biblical and Christian roots, we need to go back to the early 1600s, like New Haven, Connecticut, and their constitution, and where it was expressly established on God's law. And according to Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14, that's the reason. There was others that did similar, and that's the reason that God blessed America. The reason God cursed America is found in Deuteronomy 28, 15 through 68. And the curses that we are now under are the result of what happened with the guys who followed Jonas Phillips instead of the scriptures when it came to God's law, including his mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders.
Very revealing to me was Benjamin Franklin, and of course, to call Franklin a Christian would be, such a stretch. It's incredible. But Franklin saw in July, because all of the contentious nature of the delegates at that time, he actually proposed that they go back to daily prayers at the convention, and of course, he got a second. But then he was attacked by Alexander Hamilton, who said that he did not wish to submit those proceedings to a foreign power. And then in his biography, Benjamin Franklin said that among the delegates at the Constitutional Convention, he saw only three or maybe four who thought prayers were ever necessary. Your comments? Yeah.
Well, and I deal with that in Chapter 3 of Bible Law versus United States Constitution, which is the preamble, We the People versus Yahweh. And I'll just read it. It says, although it is true that 4 or 5 weeks into the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin proposed prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessing upon our deliberations be held in assembly, end of quote, his proposal, as you said, did not merit a vote. Franklin wrote, quote, the convention, except three or four persons, thought prayers unnecessary, end quote. And I point out, this alone is an abomination to Yahweh, where in Zephaniah 1, 4 through 6, I will cut off them that are turned back from Yahweh and those that have not sought Yahweh nor inquired for him. Paul Harvey's rest of the story, people quote Benjamin, only the first part of Benjamin Franklin's thing. You know, the pastors across this land, you hear them, ones who promote the Constitution, you hear them, they'll bring up Benjamin Franklin, that he called upon the God of heaven for the Constitution to be blessed by God. They never give the rest of the story, and that is that it was voted down, and they didn't want the prayers. And then they came up with all kinds of the naysayers tried to come up with all kinds of excuses for why that actually happened. But I address that in Chapter 3 as well in follow-up comments. But that speaks volumes where these guys were coming from.
Parson,
that's right.
What significance would you place upon the fact that from Alexander Hamilton's statement, we do not want to submit these proceedings to a foreign power, and that we now know, and they have actually claimed in several publications recently, that Hamilton was in fact Jewish?
I didn't know that either.
Yes, sir. August of this past year in 2021, several publications came up with documented evidence that Hamilton was in fact Jewish.
I find that very interesting, and I was unaware of it, but I can't say I'm surprised to find out that be the case. I'm not sure about his statement about turning it over to a foreign entity, what he necessarily meant by that, but you correct me, maybe you've looked into enough to tell me here, but to me the foreign entity in the context would have to be God and his law. Is that what he was inferring?
Well, being that Franklin had asked for prayer, I'm not exactly sure with the context what Hamilton was referring to, but he said that if we ask for prayer, in his entire dissertation was that, no, we can't do this because, number one, we will alarm the people of the community when they hear that we have resorted to prayer, which was very telling to me. And then the fact of, we cannot submit these proceedings to a foreign power. Did he in fact believe that, as you just stated, that Jesus Christ was a foreign power?
Well, again, contextually, I don't know, unless it can be proven otherwise from something he wherein he clarified it, I don't know how else you could take it any other way. I would like that quote, if you can send it to me,
I will be happy to, sir.
Appreciate it. Yeah, very much. I'll be happy to have that.
Well, let's kind of jump now to actually our chosen subject. Would you, and my question to the listeners was the Bill of Rights actually a Bill of Rights or was it a Bill of Goods? Would you give us your view on that, please, Parson?
Well, first of all, I love that title, and I'm gonna probably steal it from you and preach two or three different messages under that title, as well as probably sending this interview out to our list as well. But first of all, human rights that so many quote unquote constitutionalists love to hang their hat on. You know, we got to have our rights. Human rights are an entirely non-biblical Enlightenment concept for the purpose of making making man his own sovereign in violation of 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 15. The only one with a right, think about this, the only one with a right to anything is our God and Creator. Even life is not a right except to the Creator. It's inherent in who He is. For the rest of us, life and everything that comes with it, for the rest of us, life and everything that comes with it is a gift from and a responsibility to the one who created us. And think about it. It's inherent in who we are as the created. If life is our right, then God was obligated to create us, making him subservient to us. And in turn, he wouldn't have the authority to judge us for what's our right to do with as we please. So just before we get into any of the specific Bill of Rights or the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights, let's understand that this whole concept is a totally non-biblical concept altogether. Instead of God-given rights, it's God-expected responsibilities. There are no rights. In fact, there isn't even a Hebrew word for human rights in the Hebrew language, the language that the Old Testament was written in. They don't even have a word for it. Because obviously, you go back further enough in the Hebrew language, specifically back into the Old Testament, and it's all about responsibilities, our responsibilities to our God and Creator. There was no rights for humans. And furthermore, America was sent down the river, sent to the precipice, when they exchanged biblical responsibilities for Enlightenment rights. I have an article called America's Road to Hell, Paved with Rights. And you can just go down, everybody wants, I've got another one called Rights, everyone wants their rights. But it's not a biblical concept at all. And in fact, it's also very responsible for where we find ourselves today. Everybody's been pursuing, trying to get back what doesn't even exist. And in so doing, they've been totally sidetracked from the only answers that can ever save our nation off the precipice of moral depravity and destruction. And that's returning to our God is sovereign and his moral law is supreme, as it was in the early 1600s America. This is taken from Bible Law versus the United States Constitution. And I think I'll add here again that for those who maybe came in a little bit late to the program, if you'll go to our website, BibleVersusConstitution.org, and go over into the right-hand sidebar and find the survey, there's a 10-question survey regarding the Constitution as it compares to the Bible. Take that survey and you'll get a copy. We'll send you a copy of the free 85-page primer of the 575-book Bible Law versus the United States Constitution. In Bible Law versus Constitution, I point out that you can find these examples everywhere, but here's one. In understanding the Constitution, 10 things every Christian should know about the supreme law of the land, David Gibbs Jr. and David Gibbs III argue for unalienable rights. Quote, "Our rights come from God, not from the state. Therefore, the state cannot take them away. What Uncle Sam gives, Uncle Sam can take away. But our nation's birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence, makes clear that our rights are unalienable because they come from God." End of that quote. Now, that sounds wonderful. And you hear those kind of statements parroted all the time from quote-unquote constitutional Christians. It sounds wonderful, but is it true? And again, we've been so blinded that we can't see our hand in front of our face when it comes to what the Constitution has done to us. Now, going on from how I respond to that, the state has certainly taken away an unwanted infant's right to life. The state has incrementally taken away gun owners' Second Amendment rights. The state has taken away the right to own property. There's not an inch of private property in America today, including the ones your listeners reside on right now. We can talk about that later if we ever get to the Fifth Amendment. Going on, because rights come from the state can take them away at its pleasure. On the other hand, as pointed out in chapter 11, Yahweh's law does not recognize rights, God-given or otherwise, but only God-required responsibilities. The theory of unalienable or natural rights can be traced back to the Age of Enlightenment. The term natural rights, as employed by the 18th century men, is not compatible with the Bible. I go on to talk about Deuteronomy 28, and then instead of endowing us with rights, Yahweh expects righteousness from us. People who demand their rights are like children, focused on themselves. People who pursue righteousness are focused on Yahweh and their fellow man. The former promotes a government of, by, and for the people. The latter promotes a government of, by, and for Yahweh. And so this whole idea that so many Christians have been bamboozled into trying to pursue not only cannot be found in the Bible, they don't even exist. You and I don't have a right to anything. We have a responsibility to live our lives for the God and Creator who made us. And so the entire concept of rights, including including what we find in the Bill of Rights, is completely antithetical to what we find in the Scriptures.
Oh, all right. Well, then you and I discussed, Parson, before we came on. We were talking about, and one of my favorite phrases that just sends chills up my spine is that old canard that the Bill of Rights guarantees. I'm sorry. It just that probably those words used together probably. I mean, what can we say about a country of people, millions who believe that they have rights under the Second Amendment, when there are over 2,000 federal laws, regulations, and statutes which prohibit the ownership of certain types of weapons or weapons at all in certain locations or what have you? Parson, what kind of mindset does it take for a person to still cling to that Second Amendment when the evidence is irrefutable that you don't have any of the rights you think you have? And then after that, I want to jump into what we talked with previously about the First Amendment. But your thoughts about the Second, sir?
Well, as we were talking before the program started, I had responded to your statements about this as the fact that idols die hard, and particularly when it comes to this one, what I term as the national idol of America, and that's the United States Constitution. And I mean, and not only do idols die hard, but people are blinded to their idols. They don't even realize that they're committing idolatry. But this is very important. Idolatry is not so much about statues as it is statutes with a T-E-S on the end. It's about the laws, such as what one considers the supreme law of the land. There's only one perfect law. We read about it in Psalms 19, 7 through 11, and there's only, therefore, one supreme law of God's entire creation, and that's his moral law, his commandments, statutes, and judgments. And if you see or look to or promote or swear to anything else as the supreme law of the land, I hate to tell you, but you're an idolater, because idolatry is not so much about statues as it is statutes. America was sold down the river by the 18th century founding fathers when they replaced biblical let me back up. When they replaced non-optional biblical responsibilities with optional enlightenment rights. And that's nothing proves it better than the Second Amendment. I mean, think about it. The amendment with the wording "shall not be infringed" is the most infringed of all 27 of the amendments. I mean, talk about blind. I mean, you've pointed out the same thing yourself. But instead, compare, and some people say, well, the Bill of Rights is an optional. But what I mean by that is the Second Amendment, as one example, gives us the optional right to bear arms in defense of ourselves, our families, and others. Whereas under the Bible, there's no optional right to it. It's an expected, God-expected responsibility. For example, Psalm 149, 6 through 9, it says, "Let the high praises of God be in their mouth, and a two-edged sword," or today's equivalent, "in their hand." And then it ends by saying, "This honor have all the saints. Praise ye Yah." Tie that in with what we find in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. "But if any provide not for his own, and especially of his own household, beginning with spiritual and physical protection," there's no use providing housing, clothing, food, and such things if you're going to let the rapists and thieves and murderers come in and take it from those who you're providing it for. So it begins with spiritual and physical protection. "But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." That's 1 Timothy chapter 5, 8. Most powerful. In fact, I think that's the most powerful verse in the entire Bible on the biblical responsibility to bear arms. How much more potent? Think about that. Which is more important, an optional right or two, a non-optional responsibility? Which is more likely to be infringed and ultimately abolished altogether? And here's an interesting question, Michael, and that's, which did the pre-Second Amendment Americans look to for their authority to bear arms with little or no infringement? When we're talking pre-Second Amendment, what did they look to? Well, they looked to the scriptures. They looked to God. They looked to their biblical responsibility to bear arms in defense of themselves, their families, and their friends with little or no infringement. Since the Second Amendment, the thing has been free. You said the numbers. What's the numbers?
It's over 2,000, sir.
2,000 infringements upon that amendment. That's because it's an amendment. That's because it's a non-optional right that the government authorizes and therefore can limit at its, you know, even though the amendment itself shall not be infringed. That shows how impotent that thing really was. The Second Amendment is part of the problem, not the answer to in the fashion that most people think it is.
Well, Parson, I would be remiss, and, you know, wow, this has been such an enlightening hour here, or closing out the first hour fairly close, but I would be remiss. I read something today. We're kind of jumping ship here, but I really want your response. And when I first read this article, I thought right away I wanted to ask you, Parson, about this. And that was something that came out today that said that the Pentagon is trying to get rid of Christians in the U.S. military. What would be your response to that, sir?
Well, what comes to mind immediately is, and you'll find, anybody who's interested will also find this in Chapter 9 dealing with Article 6, the Supreme Law of the Land. Three things come to mind. First, this is any attack upon Christians publicly or in the military or in government is simply a fulfillment of what really took place back in 1789 when the Constitution was ratified and Article 6. Let's put it this way, when the Constitution per Article 6 became the supreme law of the land, which was then further established in Madison versus Marbury. I think that was 1803, thank you.
Yes, sir.
And as well as Reynolds versus the United States Constitution, arguably the two most biblically consequential Supreme Court decisions of all time, Madison versus Marbury, established that any law contrary to the Constitution is null and void, including anything found in the Bible. And there is all kinds of biblical law and principles that are contrary to what we find in the Bible. Again, that's the reason I wrote Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, the Christian Perspective. And again, you'll find it in almost every article and every amendment that where you find the Bible is contrary to what we find in the Constitution or vice versa, and therefore it's null and void. And then you get to Reynolds versus the United States when they were litigating or adjudicating in the Supreme Court the Mormons' claim under the First Amendment to practice polygamy, and they said, no way, you can't do it because it's against the law of the land. And they go on to say, I'm paraphrasing here, but you'll find it in Chapter 9, that you can have your beliefs, but not necessarily your practice, which goes contrary to everything we find in the scriptures, particularly Matthew 7, 21 through 23, and James, where faith without works is void. And so, therefore, even though I'm not promoting Mormonism as Christian, but the statements made in Reynolds versus the United States then set the path for anything Christian to be removed, Christian or biblical, that is considered contrary to the Constitution to be made null and void according to the quote-unquote law of the land. For example, and it's already happening, the preaching against sodomy, often called the gays. I won't even go into that. I won't use the word gay. They're sodomites.
Used to be such a nice word.
Yeah. You know, I believe that there are people born gay. If my second son, I swear, was born smiling. But beyond that, there's nobody who's born gay. You have to be introduced to it, proselyzed to it, and you have to be so immoral that you get involved in it. And that's when you become a sodomite. You're not born a sodomite. You become a sodomite when you practice it. But that's another issue. But the point being is that they're already starting to legislate. They've done it in other countries, in Europe and so forth, and they're starting to do it here in America as well, where they're starting to legislate against preaching against sodomy. And it goes back to Reynolds versus the United States and Madison versus Marbury, and all the way back to the fact that the Constitution was made the quote-unquote supreme law of the land.
Well, Parson, I've got a question for you, and I'm the historical nerd here. So are you familiar with the perversion that was Marbury v. Madison?
No. I mean, not off the top of my head, I'm not.
Well, are you going to be able, do you feel okay to continue into the second hour, sir?
Yeah, let's do it. I think we're just barely getting started, quite frankly.
All right. So, but anyway, let me throw this out there to you just for thought, is that the title of that case should not have been Marbury v. Madison. It should have been Marbury v. Marshall. Because John Marshall was the Secretary of State who did not deliver to Mr. Marbury his appointment to a federal judgeship. And then later, in a midnight appointment, John Adams appointed John Marshall to be Chief Justice. And then John Marshall got to sit in 1803 as a Chief Justice over an incident in which he was involved.
No, I was not aware of that.
That is a total perversion. But anyway, we are coming up very close here on our time. And so I think it's just absolutely fantastic. But I will, in the second hour, I'm going to jump into some subjects that I promised the people. And that was during our second war for independence, as I refer to it, was the people who came from Europe in 1848 and created the Republican Party and became very dominant in Lincoln's administration and into his military. And so I'm looking forward to your comments on that as we're able to move into that, sir. And I really appreciate the fact that you're able to stay over into the second hour.
You bet.